Yeah, I can hear you.
Hi, hello. Yeah, here's San Francisco, and I hope there is Bani Rampatan in somewhere in Indonesia. Is this right?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. We have a really good connection to you. So, Bani, I mean, the audience is here, and we are starting with the third day of the Ars Electronica conference, and today's general topic is politics. And you are our first speaker, but you are a kind of virtual speaker today because you're still over there in Indonesia and can't be here. Could you tell us a little bit about the story, why you're not here and why we have a Skype conference to you?
Yes, indeed, Johan. So actually, I couldn't get a visa to the United States, so that's why I'm here. So I filmed my talk beforehand, and this is the best I can do.
Okay. So it seems that we somehow tricked the State Department here, but you're actually here and you talk, and we'll be able to see your speech and your talk, but still you're somewhere on the other part of the planet. I really have to say that I like voice over IP telephony.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So we'll project your talk now. And in 45 minutes, we'll get back to you, and I hope we have a nice conversation with you, and there will be definitely a couple of questions that you probably can answer. So I will terminate the Skype connection now. We'll see the movie, and we'll get back to you in 45 minutes, okay?
Right, sure, and thanks for coming.
Yeah, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
When we think about the future of sex and porn, we tend to think about Web 3.0 with teledildonics. We tend to think about orgasms at the touch of a button. We tend to think about live streaming, geotagging of sexual activities. And you know, all this sounds pretty sweet, pretty fun. The future of porn in this way looks pretty, you know, pretty sunshine and daffodils. But I have here a very simple question. What about the future of things like Two Girls, One Cup and BME Pain Olympics? What would be the future of those bizarre, strange fetishes? My name is Bani Rampatan, and I'm here to tell you precisely what I think will the future of Pornotopia be. We noticed today that the condition of our current cyberspace porn is actually, you know, there are a lot of bizarre things. There are a lot of strange things out there. I mean, when you just go online, search for porn, it's really, really hard, and it's getting even harder and harder today to find things that are what you would now call vanilla sex. Vanilla sex, like the normal sex without all the crazy, strange fetishes, without the new trends of perversion. It becomes increasingly hard now. It becomes easier when you actually buy magazines or DVDs for those kinds of things, but online, I mean, you either have to pay a lot of money for those kinds of quote-unquote quality porn, or otherwise you'd end up with very bad quality porn, or even strange, right-out bizarre fetish porn. So, a good naive reaction to that would be like, oh, okay, so there are no exactly very few vanilla porn, they're very hard to find, and then, okay, so these people who are normally attracted to vanilla sex will be just, you know, just get offline, and then they quit surfing for porn online, and so on. That would be a very sweet thought. That would be a very wonderful, naive thought. But it turns out that the facts aren't exactly that way. The facts are rather different. The facts are, in fact, when people go online, they cannot find normal vanilla porn. What they do is exactly to learn to like these fetishes. 20 years ago, I mean, nobody would have thought that anal sex would have the popularity that it does today. So basically, my thesis here on the surface would be that all these technological developments of the internet actually pushes people, actually motivates people to have more and more bizarre sex, to explore more and more on their sexuality. So the thesis, if the main thesis of Ars Electronica is that sex drives technology, my thesis here would be that technology also drives sex, also is actively engaging in the evolution of our sexuality. It's not only that because you show bizarre porn online that you make people attracted to bizarre porn. It's really not that simple, and things couldn't be that simple. But my thesis here would be that the very language of computer, the very language of computer itself motivates people to do cybersex. And my thesis here would be to explain how the relationship between the progress of these communication technologies with our sexuality, that our sexuality is actually evolving. Now, post-human and sex, those are two words that don't usually mix together in one sentence. First of all, the post-human means that, the old more Vecchian dream of downloading your consciousness into computers, into machines, and then living as practically immortals, as floating in cyberspace, as beings floating in cyberspace. And the reaction to that, the common reaction to that, and my reaction to that would be like, floating around in cyberspace, and what do we do in cyberspace? You know, like, maybe, what, sightseeing in cyberspace? And we certainly don't have our bodies, and we couldn't, how could we possibly have sex in cyberspace without our bodies? And to take that further, would be the question is, why would anyone want to be immortal if they can't have sex? So the idea is basically that the post-human here implies this radical rupture from the body, radical departure of the body. Some would call it the emphasis on Cartesian split here is very, very, very strong. And of course the reaction to the post-human sex problem I've just mentioned is basically people would say that basically, okay, so you won't be actually floating around in cyberspace. You would be able to download your consciousness into other bodies, into other machines, into anything at all. And then you'd be able to fuck as them. So now that does make the idea a lot more interesting, because now we could actually have sex as anything, with and as anything. So the idea is this, what I mean by post-human sex is actually sex with a very contingent body, sex with a body that we choose, sex with an avatar body that could be not only cyber but also biological, technological, robotic, and so on. And we have here all kinds of dreams, all kinds of utopias based on that. I'm sure you're all familiar. I mean, that's the point why we're all here. So in my paper, I'd like to explicate some of the underlying theses behind that. The first part of this lecture is called "Could It Be?" And you may recall that it's exactly the same, has exactly the same title with this year's theme song of Ars Electronica, "Could It Be?" Well, it is exactly indeed where I got the title from, because here I would like to show you the basics of my theory by looking at the wonderful video that our friends in Monochrome have made. So basically in this video, "Could It Be?" is the story of two gay subroutines. I mean, how did we come to ever think of gay subroutines, and how did we ever come to visualize the gay subroutines as those square pixels? I hope you're already familiar with the video also, because I'll be here referring to that video. And first of all, so the basic question would be, why such a signifier? Why would you portray gay subroutines? Of course here, like, subroutines are here conveyed as very fully sentient beings, sentient sexual beings here. But why would you convey sexual beings as square dots? Why would you use such a signifier? And to put it in a deconstructive way, can we actually take square pixels as signifiers of sexual subjects? Now this is a very interesting question, because to signify is to abstract. And to abstract is, of course, to generate a certain kind of general universality of an object that you're abstracting. Say, for example, let's take the case of a face here. The very minimum abstraction of a face, that you could still call it a face, is basically the familiar one, two dots, one line. Two dots, one line, whichever way you rotate it, you could always see it as a face. Precisely because you could derive eyes from those two dots, and you could derive a mouth from that line, then anything with two dots and one line, you could basically call that as a face. You could easily imagine cars as faces, because they have lamps as those two dots, and they have the bumper as the line. You could also imagine electrical sockets as a face, because it has that general two dots, although maybe it lacks the one line, but you could easily make that up by the line in the bottom of the socket or whatever. So basically, it's easy to derive things from their abstraction. So here we come to a very interesting point. The abstraction of sexual subjects in the video, what are they? They are precisely dots, precisely pixels, precisely square objects without any limbs, without any face. And basically, they are the utmost simple abstraction. They're the utmost abstract figure you can get from sexual subjects. And what do they signify? Here I would claim that they signify nothing but the minimum signifier of a countable object. So here we have a face as two dots, one line, and on the other hand we have sexual subjects as countable nouns, countable objects. So if you can derive anything from two dots, one line as a face, what does it mean? Exactly, it means that you could derive anything sexual, any sexual subject, from a square pixel. Now, that raises a lot of interesting questions. Now, basically, our notion of subjective sexuality here is, first of all, a lot more abstract than actually our notion of a face, even. So you don't have to have a face to have sex. And, you know, there are a lot of bizarre things about this. You don't even have to have any formal body as such to be a sexual subject. You could be anything as long as it's countable, but you can't really, well, we haven't come to the imagination of having sex as air, for example. No, I don't think we've come to that realization just yet, but as stones, as, you know, as chairs, I think we have actually come to that realization in a way. And how did we come to that? How did we ever come to take countable nouns as sexual subjects? First of all, I'd like to trace back a little bit of the history of since when do we take digital dots as our signifiers, as it were. The answer came to me right away, actually. Probably since the time, well, not actually probably, but I think really it is since the time of radars. If radars, you know, they scan animate objects as present there, so animate objects, which means, you know, us sentient beings, as digital dots. So since the time of radars, we are already associating ourselves with digital dots. Maybe it's our place, but the basic thing is it's another subject. So we may want to take this a little bit further, so as to, was it to shed the digital part and maintain the minimum dot part? And we can go pretty far, actually, since the very early times of military, the very early times of wartime, you can already envision people actually sketching out on dirt with sticks about their military tactics. They sketch out on dirt, they put a line, they mark an X, they mark dots, say, hey, here's the subject, here's us, and here are the enemy, here's us, and then that this is what we'll do, they sketch out lines and so on. Yeah, so it's all fine and good there. We could always think of ourselves as dots. But these are all in the context of purely military statistical needs. You know, We don't. Even if in those times of radar, for example, we don't think of actually using these dots and crashing them together to have sex on the screen, you know. And also for the times when we sketch up military stuff sketch up ourselves as dots on the ground, we don't really use those dots to imagine sexual activities. If we want to imagine sexual activities, then we actually bother to add limbs to them, for example. Yeah, so that means we still needed limbs, we still needed a humanoid body to have sex. But we see now with this video, could it be especially, I think it's a wonderful example, we see now that we don't even need a humanoid body anymore. Even a pixel will suffice it. Now, since when are these pixels, when do these pixels suffice a subjective experience? Video games, as we see, take these digital characters, and make us engage fully to control them and to have fun with them, you know, to make them reach the end, for example, to make Mario save his princess, and yeah, but the curious fundamental notion of video games is basically that they evolve right out of these war simulations. That if you all know the, like Pong, for example, or the early war games, they all come out of cybernetic research and military simulations in the ages of World War II and post World War II, and they eventually became video games. So here we have a very interesting logic. First of all, we think of ourselves in intimate relationships as, you know, as humanoid figures, as stick figures, possibly, you know, like we draw people as stick figures, and then we take it to a military context, and then we have, okay, let's forget the limbs, let's forget the head, let's just draw the dots. We only need the dots to achieve a certain goal, for example, And then video games have said, and then said that, hey, we can achieve a certain goal, and the certain goal does not have to be a real political war context. It could be a fun context. And then now we can take these pixels that may not be humanoid as purely subjective signifiers. And then, of course, later, maybe about 3 hours later, I'm guessing, that people started thinking about using these not only as adventure or war games, but also as sexual signifiers. So, yeah, here we have a very interesting logic that actually war technologies and video games shape ourselves to begin to think in other ways about our own body, begin to use avatars as tools of having fun. Of course, now we use avatars all the time, perhaps more than we use our actual body for social interaction now with the advent of Web 2.0 and then the social web, social media, and so on. But the very interesting here is that technology makes us think differently about our bodies. And then that is, first of all, the visual part. And then we can also look at this video, at the Could It Be video, in the audio part, in the songs part, in the lyrics part, in the voice part. Now, if you're familiar with psychoanalysis, you're gonna know that actually the role of the voice has actually a role in actually giving a life to our body, to even our physical entity. When we learn to speak, we actually engage in this certain symbolic world as already a certain avatar, if you could call it that. So right now we maintain those pixels as the utmost abstraction of sexual subjects, but the voice, we give them fully the voice, a very passionate character, should we say. Actually, two pixels that are gay and being in love. I mean, that's very passionate, that's very romantic, and The strange thing, of course, the very interesting, the very wonderful thing of the video is that you can maintain the abstraction of the subject, while at the same time you also maintain the complexity of the emotions signified by the lyrics and by the song, by the voice of the song. So here we now have several theses of the post-human sex that I have just mentioned. The first of all would be the transformability of the bodies. The transformability of bodies is, like I have mentioned before, is that since we now can view sexual subjects as subjects that are any subject that are derived from a basic countable noun, doesn't even have to be humanoid, then our bodies can also be transformed. The way we understand our bodies right now is that we can actually transform our sexual bodies to be anything we want. The second point is the insolubility of life. You could call it that. The insolubility of life here means, even though it's really a total abstract figure, non-humanoid, a basic simple dot, we can still use a very human, a very warm, intimate, romantic, passionate voice as the voices of these pixel characters. The third interesting aspect, the third interesting point that I would like to make here is the total programmability of this all. There's this certain notion that you could actually program the intimacy of these two pixels. The ultimate proof would be that these two pixels are subroutines. They're cyborgs, they're programmed cyborgs, but nevertheless, they have this certain dimension of programmability in them. The second point of my lecture here is titled On the Body Problem, Photoshop and Inherent Mutability. By inherent mutability here, I'm referring to the concept of William Mitchell. William Mitchell here essentially says that, yeah, you know, a very obvious logic here is that to a computer, it doesn't matter what picture you show it. It basically treats it the same way, whether you show a masterpiece photography or some scribbles done by a 5-year-old in MS Paint. The computer does not take those two pictures as different pictures. Well, of course, there are different pictures by terms of file names and pixel locations, but essentially if you format them as JPEG, they're both JPEG. They're both subject to manipulation. You can the same clicks, the same Photoshop filters will have the same effects on both of these pictures, the photographic realistic photography or the MS Paint stuff, will have the same effect on both of these pictures. So the computer does not tell this minimum realistic difference. There is none of that in a computer, since it only operates basically on the level of the pixel. The point is that these pixels here are basically the same from photos and these MS Paint. And what does this have to do with us? Basically that our avatars are now mutants. Okay, now we have learned that our understanding of our body is contingent with the technologies that we are involved in doing and using right now. So the next question would be, if our bodies are affected by these kinds of new technologies, then it must mean that our gender, our sexuality is also affected by these new technologies. And yes, and that is what I'm going to talk about in this third lecture. We have discussed a little bit about the inherent mutability, about our understanding of the body and so on. So now let's talk about psychoanalysis a little bit. I won't dwell too deep on Lacanian theories and so on, but let's just talk about it in a brief way. If you remember psychoanalysis at all, you probably remember that the apex of the nightmare of psychoanalysis, of Freudian psychoanalysis, is the castration complex. So basically, people are afraid that they will lose the penis, the phallus here. And then comes a natural proof of this, which means that if you look at the old forms of artworks and literature and horror stories, you're gonna notice that basically all kinds of the evildoers, all kinds of the baddies there could always be traced back to the feminine. If there's only a certain figure that can be traced back to the feminine would be like the demon lord, the male demon lord, which is an evil father, which is, you know, the subconscious desires to kill the father and so on. But the essential thing about this is that there are numerous feminine figures in the past that are always being put as the bad guys, as the source of sin and so on. That was in the times of Freud. Well, now when we look at the bad guys of today, what do we have? We have all kinds of those freaky monsters. In the times of Freud, he didn't watch the Cloverfield Monster, he didn't watch Godzilla, he didn't watch Ultraman and all those, you know, kick-ass, geeky, giant monster movies. He didn't watch Cronenberg. Now, you might ask, what does this have to do with Freudian psychoanalysis? Well, basically everything. Because you can actually know the fears of people by looking at the bad guys in the contemporary, you know, artworks, the contemporary pieces of art, films and so on. Why does our understanding of evildoers today no longer feminine? Well, of course that, you know, feminism has won. That would be a very positive notion, and I think a correct one also, that feminism has we have come to take feminism as more and more acceptable, if not fully acceptable. The point here is that the feminine is now already elevated into a not so evil subject. So who are the evil subjects now? But are all of these monsters evil? Some might say, oh well, monsters are so feminine because they come from nature, and nature is, of course, feminine by terms of deep feminism and so on. But no, I would claim that these monsters are not evil because of feminine. Even Godzilla, who is a mother, is not evil because she is a mother. She's evil because she is precisely a mutant. That is why she is evil. That is why the Cloverfield Monster is evil. That's why Maldan Seijin from Ultraman is evil. That's why a lot of these monsters today is evil. That's why Magneto is evil and so on. So basically now we have come a long way from our sexist past. We no longer take the feminine as the utmost, as the utmost source of all evil, but we now take the mutants as the source of all evil, which is a very interesting point here. The feminine is actually defined by her lack of the penis, her lack of the phallic, her lack of the physical outward phallic signifier, as it were. But what defines the mutants? It's not the lack of the penis, it's not the lack of the phallus, it's the production of that phallus gone wrong. It's the usage of the certain phallus called the technology that has gone all wrong and has produced a radical source of evil, the mutants here. The strange thing about mutation here is that mutation could lead either to a loss of the penis, like if you watch Cronenberg's The Fly, the penis of the character falls off and so on. So the mutant basically has no more penis. But then there are also another kind of mutants, like for example tentacle hentai, where they sprout numerous amounts of penis. So instead of losing the penis, they sprout numerous amounts of these crazy long penises and so on. So basically here we have a very strange shift from we are afraid from losing our penis to, you know, the castration complex, and we are now shifting to what Catherine Hales called the mutation complex, and that is one of the primary signals of the post-human, as Hales put it. There's another, a more interesting notion of this that I would like also to point out here is that women in the past aren't all bad. They are also the primary source of our, you know, the universal beauty that we, you know, that we in the classical painting and so on. The woman provides this transcendent realm of beauty and so on. We no longer have that today. I mean, we no longer have that transcendent beauty, the transcendent notion of beauty. But what do we dream of today, basically? Yeah, basically a mutation that has gone right instead of wrong. So the contingency of mutation here becomes also a source of fascination, as is the castration becomes a source of fascination. Mutation also becomes a source of fascination. So we no longer look to a woman for, she is so beautiful, she is the beauty of transcendence and so on. But now we look to mutated figures to look for this beauty. Very concrete examples. Superheroes are all mutants, and they're people like them because they can do, you know, these crazy shit, even though they are still perfectly human. They have to have that human side. And of course, a more concrete notion would be photoshoppery of, you know, digital retouching of those photos. Why do we not take real photos of real women as the utmost beauty? It is because we don't take the real beauty as the beauty of real women anymore, but we take the real beauty, the transcendent beauty, as the beauty of the mutants. That's why we love Photoshop. So this generally means that you are attracted. We now are attracted to things that are not real. You're no longer attracted to women that are, you know, shaved, plumped in, and those pictures of women that are painted in classical paintings. No, you're attracted to those, you know, lesbian nymphos in porn movies. You just can't stop to have it. Well, why are you attracted to that, to them? It's basically not because they are, you know, women who with transcendent beauty. It's because they're mutants. They're mutants in the sense that, you know, porn is not realistic. Porn is elevated into that kind of sexual utopia that these porn stars are elevated as mutants into the sexual utopia. You can endure such pain, you can endure such numerous amounts of insertion with all these weird stuff and, you know, all the cum shots and so on. You have all those extreme gonzo figures. So that becomes clear, doesn't it, why we take all these crazy fetishes to be more and more common, and why are there proliferating such kinds of stuff in the darkest realms of the internet, like macrophilia snuff or scat porn, scatological orgies, and, you know, pedophilia furries and so on. Well, it not becomes natural, isn't it? Once we look at it this way, hey, they're all mutants. They're all just the same notion of transcendent beauty. We come now to the fourth part of my lecture on the politics problem, the future of pornotopia. Okay, so we now basically understand, I hope you now understand that our sexuality is actually evolving with technology. But then let's put this notion into Ars Electronica's main theme, which is that sexuality also drives technology. So basically now what we have here is a constant feedback loop. It's a nonlinear function. It's a feedback loop that says, okay, sexuality drives technology and technology drives sexuality in turn. So now what we have in a feedback loop is basically something a lot more complex than linearity. So now it would be naive to say that to think that our future will be just sunshine and daffodils, you know, like, oh, okay, we're safe, Web 3.0 without any harm and so on. No, I think especially with the notions of today's liberal politics, you know, political correctness and so on, to accept otherness and so on, I think the demand would be not to use these technologies only for the sake of, you know, enhancing our own pleasure, but people will rise up and say, yeah, what about using technology to help all those sexual minority groups that are in need, that cannot actually explore their sexuality as well as us? Why don't we use these technologies instead of focusing funds on technologies to make better and better vibrators? Why don't we focus funds on making, for example, a very crude, obscene one would be to make sterile excrements for coprophiliacs, or to make, you know, clones of bodies for snuff bands. You know, lifeless bodies could be, you just chop them to snuff bands. They could explore their sexuality by chopping up their body. Okay, no life is harmed and everything goes perfectly well. Because here we have in this permissive liberal political correctness, we have here a certain injunction to continuously give way to minority otherness. What we don't realize here is, of course, that maybe we are the ones who created this minority sexual groups in the first place, maybe with technology and so on. But with this kind of feedback loop, what would happen is presumably that we will be demanded, morally obliged, to create these kinds of nightmarish stuff. Well, now we would call it nightmarish. These nightmarish stuff, which means our future may be full of, you know, sterile experimental stuff for bodies and so on. And then to take this back to our primary notion that this technology drives sexuality, what would happen? If women now go to consultations, not to consult that, oh, I cannot enjoy sex with my partner and so on, like the traditional women. Now, they no longer do that, as Auditor Salvia's talk in last year's Ars Electronica, maybe she's here. And the curious thing about today's sexual consultation is that they no longer ask those kinds of stuff, but they ask, how can I enjoy anal sex? How could I enjoy this kind of sex? How could I enjoy this kind of position while being safe? How is the way to actually tie each other up without hurting each other too much? What is the proper BDSM technique and so on? I mean, you know, the whole point is that this would be absolutely unthinkable in 20 years ago. I mean, these kinds were bizarre fetishes. And then you might want to ask yourself, if that is popular and if in the future, sex has lost, even the most bizarre fetishes has lost all of their malignant properties. Okay, you could chop each other up because you're immortal, and you know, the Moravian dream comes true, and then you could burn each other up because they have developed certain biotechnologically fire resistant skin, and then you could actually. You could do all kinds of scatological parties because your excrement, your shit is no longer bad for your health. They are healthy, maybe even good for your health even. So basically here is that the thesis is that sexuality will, all these kinds of these bizarre fetishes, we now call them bizarre because they are not only bizarre but because they are harmful. That's why we have all of our rights to disapprove of them. They are harmful, they are strange, so let's not do them. But what if technology and this political correctness and so on actually demands us to create technologies that will deprive all the malignant properties of these fetish and sex? Then what will happen? So we have all these kinds of bizarre fetishes without their malignant properties, and we have an injunction, a contemporary postmodern injunction, to continuously explore sexualities in the newest, latest trends of perversion. You know, a future of a pornotopia where our grandchildren enjoys all these kinds of bizarre fetishes and looks at us with a disdained look, that if we cannot appreciate their sexual preferences, their sexuality, you know, hey, come on, why? Isn't it logical if we enjoy having sex with shit because shit is already now healthy and so on? Hey, yeah, we have that kind of nightmarish pornotopia. Another point I'd like to make is, will everyone enjoy it? Now, we have here a certain kind of sexual liberty that is not exactly a sexual liberty, as I would call it. A crude, concrete example. Stand up in this room right now and then just say out loud that you don't have sex. You don't like having sex. Of course, the reaction would be guessable. I won't explain too much. I think you can think about that yourself. But the basic thing is, already today we are making fun of those who enjoy only vanilla sex. Of course, the conservatives are out of the question. You know, we laugh at them. Okay, abstinence only sex is stupid and so on. But now we also laugh at those who doesn't enjoy sex. Last time there was a book, I forgot by whom, called How to Enjoy It. You know, and learning to embrace your lower libido by enjoying, chocolate better than sex and so on. You know, already people are giving these liberals are giving them, the harshest look, the harshest attitude. Because how could you say that? You're impeding the progress of sexually positive feminism and so on. You're impeding the progress of that. So basically, we now make fun of people who don't enjoy sex. We make fun of people who enjoy only vanilla sex, who are not willing to explore more their sexualities. So now we have a very strong sexual tension here between those who do not exactly enjoy sex, but they are now forced to do it, forced to enjoy this more and more bizarre sex. So here we have an obscene reversal of sexual libertinism here, that not only that we can, the thesis here is now, we say that we are allowed to enjoy all kinds of sex, but the truth is, we are not allowed to enjoy bizarre sex, we are obliged to enjoy them. So there is an oppression. To take this back into to the thesis of the future for utopia, it will be nightmarish if things keep on going on like this. I'm a pessimist here. I'm being a very pessimist here, that the future of our pornotopia will be a very distressful one with all these kinds. We will be forced, our grandchildren will be forced to enjoy these bizarre, even more bizarre fetishes, even increasingly bizarre fetishes. The reason is only because you ought to enjoy them, because there are no more malignant properties and enjoyment is the only thing to do. And what we have to do here is actually today to develop a pornotopia that actually allows people to enjoy, but also allows people to not enjoy. So, okay, go do whatever you want. We don't really care. Do whatever you want. But please don't force us to enjoy the same thing as you want. I hope that gives us an insight, and thank you very much.
Yeah, so, I hope you all enjoyed the presentation.
I definitely enjoyed it. So maybe there are a couple of questions from the audience. So I'm looking around.
Yes.
Any questions? Okay, yes, there is one.
I only caught the tail end of your presentation, unfortunately. But it sounds like maybe you were first seeing people that are like asexual being outcasts in the future, people who just genuinely don't like sex with anybody or anything, being outcast, being treated maybe the same way in the media that people are people who are into BDSM are treated now, where people are into BDSM are portrayed as serial killers, or the person that's going to go beat their girlfriend, things like that.
Yes. 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 That's generally the general notion, but it doesn't have to be the asexual people. What I'm saying here is exactly that. People with lower libidos are actually oppressed within this sort of sexual libertinism. So we have some sort of, the obverse of the libertinism here is actually oppression towards these people.
So, Bonnie, would you say that the pornotopia that you're talking about, is it in a certain way trying to, let's say, I'll take a different example. There was just a couple of decades ago, space travel was a big, big thing. Space travel was the ultimate utopia. It was the super utopia of modernism in a certain way.
Yes, exactly.
Could you see, like, now there's what is left to colonize? And in a certain way, could I say there is like a colonization of the body going on, or of the body-mind complex in a certain way nowadays?
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect analogy. I think the, what is it, our vision of the future tend to forget about these things that are going on inside our body, inside our psychoanalytic development, as it were.
Okay. Any questions?
So I'd like to add a little bit here.
Of course.
Actually what I'm saying here is not to create a pornotopia that restricts enjoyment. I'm not at all saying that. I think enjoyment should be condoned and endorsed, but also we have to create a space in order for people not to enjoy. So it's not the same as preventing people from having their enjoyment as wild as they can, but also we have to create another space to let people not to enjoy.
Okay, then I would like to add another question. The name of your blog is the Posthuman Marxist.
Okay? Yes.
So, and there is a big thing in Marxist theory that it's called the fetish critique. Of course,
yes,
Marx
yes.
is not talking about a fetish that we would talk about,
yeah.
a fetish in like
yes.
a sexual connotation. But could you maybe
yes.
talk a little bit about this relationship maybe between like the Marxist term of the fetish and maybe the fetish term we are talking here about?
Yes, there's this interesting going on with the increasing commodification of sex, is that we tend to think of sex as more replaceable with other things. So the definition of sex, I think Rudy Rucker yesterday has talked about this, and I think the definition of sex here is radically changing, so that we can now call like even exchanging text messages can be seen as a sexual activity. So I think the fetishism here is like we can connect it to the commodification of sex. If
okay.
that makes sense.
Okay, wonderful. Any more comments? Okay.
Okay.
I think I'll ask a final question. It would be last year's topic was, and you talked about that in your presentation, pornography and technological innovation. This year we are talking about sexuality and science fiction. What
yes.
do you think would be an interesting direction to go for next year's Ars Electronica? Because we've been thinking here at the conference about a general topic for next year. What do you think are the really interesting main themes going on in the realms of sex and technology that would be really interesting to explore on a wider scale?
Ah, okay. So, well, for me personally, I think I'm very... There's this very interesting article by Slavoj Žižek called Posthuman, we're no sex please, we're posthuman. So I think that tells a lot about what it means to be posthuman and sexual at the same time. So basically here the notion is that the more and more we externalize our sexuality with different activities, is the less and less we become sexual inherently. So yeah, I think that's something interesting for me.
Okay, you're just for a couple of people who arrived lately, Bonnie Rambutan is sitting in Indonesia, and he's not here with us today because he couldn't get a visa from the U.S. State Department, so they wouldn't let him into the country. So that's why we're having a Skype connection here. And actually, I'm quite happy that we tricked the State Department in having a conversation here with you.
Yes, me
so,
too.
What do you think, maybe a last question, what do you think, because you're in Indonesia, and there's a lot of talking about, you know, sexuality, technology, in the Western context, and especially
yeah.
if you're thinking about Indonesia, would it be an interesting discussion to talk about sexuality, technology, and cultural differences all over the planet in different cultures and different regions on the planet?
Well, personally, I don't really believe in the in the what is it, inherently different cultures. So because for me, I think the only thing different about sexuality in different places is that how people react to them, and especially how technology has changed their how they view their bodies in certain cultures.
Okay, we have one more question. 1 second.
Hi, I'm curious about, you know, you mentioned a couple of times having this kind of space where it's safe to not sexualize things, and I think one thing that's come up, people have mentioned a few times this story, Eye of Gomorrah, where I guess there were some eunuchs, and then they become this, like, sexual fetish, and I'm wondering what you think about this. It seems like, as humans, we have this tendency to sexualize everything, even celibacy, so I wonder how you think we could prevent that, or what you think about that.
Okay. Well, first, I can't exactly give the way exactly how to prevent that. Here, I'm only talking to redefine the problems. And one interesting about sexualizing everything is it paradoxically actually also at the same time desexualizes everything. Like, I use this example quite a lot in countries where they have lots and lots of pornography, in this sense, lots and lots of good pornography, especially like feminist pornography and so on. The inherent understanding is that in real life you shouldn't treat women that way, like violently and so on. I don't really believe in this simplistic notion. If you watch pornography, then you go and rape someone. I totally don't believe in that kind of notion. So I think paradoxically here, if you want to sexualize everything, That actually means that we want to radically desexualize ourselves at the same time, if that makes some sort of sense.
Okay. Maybe an additional question, like.
Okay. So as sort of a follow up to that, then there was a little conversation yesterday about virtual worlds and people behaving sort of inappropriately in these virtual worlds, and whether it was a good thing or a bad thing to allow them to do it in this place where either it was, you know, was it either preventing them from doing these things in the real world, or was it sort of encouraging that kind of behavior? I'm not sure what my question is, but I'm just curious how this fits into what you're discussing.
I think people tend to be more impolite, if you could say that, more impolite online when they are certain that they have certain privacies and they can take on other personalities with their avatars. But as far as privacy goes, if you use your real identity online, it will be more dangerous. So I think the proper way to prevent, like, online perversion, like impolite, unconsensual online perversion from going on, is that to actually delve more into this privacy stuff. So the more we're dug up about our privacy, the less we become, the more we become restricted, and like morally.
Okay, I guess we have to go to our next speaker. So thanks a lot for being here. What's the time over there in Indonesia?
Thank you.
Actually, what's the time and what time zone are you at the moment?
excuse me?
Is it late at night in Indonesia now, or is it early in the morning?
Oh, it's actually 4:30 a.m.
It's 4:30 a.m. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
Four
you.
Oh my God. Okay. Thanks, or my non-existing God, actually. Okay. Thanks a lot for having you on the show here. And
yes, having me.
Best wishes. Bye-bye.
Bye.